This week on the show, we're going to talk about some reselling news from eBay and Amazon, and I will attempt to tackle a question from a listener about when you should consider going full-time as a reseller. What is up, Galaxians? Welcome to episode number, I believe it's 341 of the Galaxy CDs Rocks and Flips Reseller Talk podcast. My name is Ryan, and I am a full-time reseller, which is relevant to today's topic, and a part-time YouTuber and podcaster talking about all things reselling. We've got a little bit of reselling news this week. Obviously, the big news over the last couple of weeks has been the discussion around the changes over at Mercari. I did do a separate video on that, which many of you have already watched and commented on. And I appreciate that very much. Thoughts are still very mixed on what's going on over there. I did have almost a week after the change where I did not make a single sale. Things seem to be returning a little bit to normal. I've had a real mixed bag. I've had some of my older items that have automatically been converted over to the new system. I've had some new items that sold, even though they have the additional fees. So I'm still pretty up in the air about whether the changes have actually been beneficial or not. I guess time will tell. As I said, we've got a little bit of reselling news. I've got a pretty big what sold recap because I haven't done one in a couple of weeks. But we're going to start with a question that I received from my friend Brandon, the media picker, over on Instagram. So this is a question, frankly, that a lot of resellers have from time to time. It's a topic I've covered kind of generally previously, but I wanted to go over it in some depth because it does come up pretty frequently, and there's a lot of various information out there that I want to discuss. So Brandon asked, and thank you very much for the question, at what point in your reselling journey did you think or know when you could do it full time? Without going into financial details, was it based on a certain number of average of gross / net sales per day by dollar amount or quantity sold? Did you have in mind a number of active listings you wanted before making this transition? Also, how were you able to ramp up your store to have a large amount of listings? He goes on to say, it seems as I ramp up my store in quantity, I'm obviously selling more, which is kind of the goal. I listed 8 yesterday and sold 9. If everything being roughly equal based on my current numbers, currently up 40% over last year, congratulations, that's a huge increase. I'm up about 5%. I'll need about 6,000 in active listings to hit the gross numbers I want and roughly the projected net numbers I want to where I could do this full time. Just needing your expertise. Appreciate your time as always. Again, Brandon, thank you very much for the question. So I have thoughts. So the short answer is there is no one answer, and there's certainly no easy answer to that question. To Brandon's credit, he's done some of the work that I'm going to talk about in this episode about how you might arrive at what that decision would be. But unfortunately, there can't really be one answer. Every situation is different. I've seen other resellers discuss this topic, and if they give you just like a generic answer, in my opinion, that's not particularly helpful because your situation is different from mine, then from that person's, and so on. Everybody's got a different idea. I've heard sellers say that you need to make 50% more than your current salary. You need to make at least your current salary. You need to make double your current salary on your current full-time job. If I had listened to that advice, I'd still be in my last job. I'm not making anywhere near what I made in my last job, but that, for me, personally, was not the goal. My goal, as I've talked about on this show with some regularity, was to take control of my time. I wanted to find something that I could do, that I could make a living at, but not work 50, 60 hours a week on someone else's schedule, giving up time where I could be out doing things I wanted to do and restructure my work. So I left the traditional workforce to get that time back. It was not necessarily about the money for me. So if I had waited when I started doing this part-time until I made really any kind of money at all, I probably still would be doing it part-time. My story, if you don't know, in August of 2019, I started dabbling in reselling. I went down the YouTube rabbit hole while looking for something like that and decided to give it a try. And within 30 days, I gave 30 days notice at my job and went full time. So in less than 2 months' time from starting, essentially from scratch on this, I was a full-time reseller. And I've been doing it ever since. It's 4.5 years now. It was October of 2019 that I started full-time. But my situation was very different. Again, I was doing it to claw back my time, not necessarily to make a lot of money. I was in a pretty good position financially. I didn't have a lot of bills, a modest house payment, a modest car payment, no debt. My daughter has graduated from college and on with her life. I'm an empty nester. I had some significant savings and investments available so that if this was not an immediate success, I had some cushion that I could rely on until I built my business up. That is a very, very different situation from someone who has a family, 2, 3 kids, a spouse, a big mortgage, 2 car payments, student loan debt, a sick relative, whatever the case may be. And for me or any reseller to say, you need to make X amount of your current salary, I just don't think is particularly helpful because that does not reflect my situation versus someone who is in that situation with a bunch of other bills and responsibilities. So bear that in mind as we go through this. My goal is in this, maybe not to answer the question specifically about how to know when you should go full-time as a reseller, but some of the things you should be thinking about as you consider making that move. So the first thing I would say is you need to know your level of risk tolerance. And I bring that up because it makes a huge, huge difference in your outlook on the situation. How are you going to feel on that first Friday when you don't get your regular paycheck? Is that going to be interesting, exciting? Is it going to leave a pit in your stomach and a massive migraine? Are you going to be nervous and worried about how you're going to pay your bills? If you've waited until you're making double your current salary on your job, you probably don't have that issue. But I don't know that a lot of people get to that point. A lot of people want to make this move earlier rather than later. So it's important to know your level of risk tolerance. And I'll relay a story from a time I was not reselling. I was selling cars. And I started kind of at the same time as another fella. And we had very similar backgrounds. Multiple years of retail management and customer service experience. We were both empty nesters, modest bills, same kind of experiences, same kind of personality. We could have been the same person. In fact, people thought we were brothers at one point. We were that similar. Where we differed in this 100% commission job was that I was supremely confident that I was going to be able to be successful at this job. If I went a day, 2 days, 3 days, 5 days without making a sale, I just knew in my heart and in my soul that the next day I would make a sale or two or three. And at the end of the month, I was going to have made a good amount of money. The other fella, despite having all of the same skills and abilities that I had, did not have that same confidence. He was very nervous about not having a steady, consistent paycheck. And if he went a day, 2 days, 5 days without making a sale, he would get into his own head. He would literally become physically ill. He was so stressed out about it. And that affected his performance, the way he interacted with people, the way he talked to and or tried to pressure people, the corners he cut trying to get through a process more quickly to make more sales. It impacts your ability to do the work that you need to do when you're that stressed. And the upshot of it was that within 3 months, I was consistently one of the top 3 or 4 salespeople in the dealership. And he went back to the service department to become an oil change technician. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that is the difference in the level of this kind of job. And reselling is very much like that. There is no consistent paycheck. 1 week, I'll give you the example of a couple of weeks ago for me in my business. Normally, I process anywhere from 85 to 105 transactions, listings sold per week. A couple of weeks ago, that number was down around 70, and the average selling price that particular week was also pretty bad. The net was that my gross sales were about half what they normally are. If that happened to you, and it's going to, I can guarantee you're going to have a bad day, a bad week, maybe even a bad month. How are you going to respond? Is that going to put so much stress on you that it affects your family life? Your ability to enjoy life, your ability to do the job. Will you start cutting corners? Will you start discounting things that you shouldn't discount in order to try to make some extra money? How are you going to respond to that? Neither is right or wrong. Some people need the structure of a traditional job and the consistency of a regular paycheck. And if that is you, going full-time in this business may not be the best option for you, as attractive as it may seem on the surface. So that would be the first thing. Know your tolerance for risk. How much can you bear? How long can you go without knowing how much money you're going to make? That really almost never really goes away. It's always in the back of your mind. You're a bad day or two bad days away from potentially being stressed out about it. And if that is you and you need that structure, really think hard about whether becoming a full-time reseller is actually the right thing for you to do. The second thing, and this was again an advantage that I had when I made my transition into this, is know your level of skill in the various areas that are going to be required to actually run a full-time business. If you're doing this part-time to earn some extra money, some of the things that you can get away with maybe as a reseller part-time, you would not be able or you would not want to do if this was your sole source of income. So know your skills. Can you control your inventory? Do you know some basic accounting so you can keep track of your expenses and your income and know if you're actually really making any money or not, or if you're losing money but you've got some cash flow? You need to be able to understand that. Do you have good grammar? Are your listings, do they look professional? Are they spelled properly? Do they have good photos? Do you have those skill sets so that you can be successful? My business background was 30 plus years of retail management and customer service. I had owned my own retail shop for about a dozen years previously, so I knew some of the pitfalls of being an entrepreneur, of being self-employed going in. So I brought those skills to bear when I went full-time with this. So I knew, again, I had that confidence level because of my skills that I could go full-time. So be very self-critical about the things that you know and the things that you don't know about running a business, and either figure out how to learn those things or whether you want to outsource them. Not everybody wants to do accounting, but you need to know a certain level of it so that you can keep good records, so that if you pass all this stuff onto an accountant at some point down the road, it's not chaos at tax time. So be very critical of your own set of skills and how they will apply to being a reseller, and learn the things that you think you don't know before you jump in full time. The last thing, and this is the one where most people are the most interested, is determine what your income levels need to be. You got to start with your finances and sort them out. You may want to make $30,000 a year, or you may want to make $300,000 a year. And those targets are obviously very different. It's one of the reasons that I talk about where it's very difficult to just give generic advice, because somebody that wants to make $30,000 a year is in a very, very different situation than somebody who wants to make $300,000 a year. Your business needs to be run differently. You need to source probably different things. You need to have a very different conversation with yourself about how you get to that number. The key thing, for me at least, was to begin with the end in mind. Know what that number is. Whether it's 30 or 300, know where you need to get, and then begin a process of evaluating how it is you actually get there. You need to also bear in mind with this number that it's not just about your raw salary, your raw income. You need to consider things like health insurance, retirement plans, the additional tax burdens that you may face as a reseller. If you're a sole proprietor, for instance, you're going to pay both halves of your Social Security and Medicare tax, where your employer has previously been paying half of that. So those are things that you need to consider. And you could just say generically, make 50% more than you're making on your current salary to cover all of those things. But that doesn't account for the type of lifestyle that you want to lead or any other individual things in your life that may impact what that number should be. So think about that. It's more than just your base salary, but you need to do that, again, self-evaluation, and determine where it is you want to be financially. then, of course, you got to figure out how much stuff you got to sell in order to get there. And that, again, to Brandon's credit, is a investigation that he's already done. And he's landed on a potential number. He said 6,000 active listings to achieve where he wants to be. When I did mine initially, and we'll talk about it here in a little bit, I did a similar exercise, and I think I came up with like 5,000 as kind of a minimum to hit my minimum financial targets to do this. It varies, again, wildly depending on what your niche is. If you are, like me, a media seller with a fairly high volume of transactions but a fairly low average selling price, the number of listings you need is obviously very different than someone who is selling electronics or auto parts or expensive handbags and clothing. So again, it's a process of evaluating your niche and deciding where you can make the most impact with your listings. So I'm just going to run through an example of the things that I considered. So how many sales do I need to make to get to that number? I looked at the average selling price in my target area, which in my case was media. What do these things sell for, and how much I can expect to pay for these items in your market? And again, the in your market thing is very important. Again, your situation is different. Things are going to be more expensive in a big city or on the coasts than they are in the Midwest, and that affects your ability, because a book, for instance, that has a market value of $20 may cost a dollar or two at a garage sale in North Dakota, but it may cost $8 or $10 at a garage or estate sale on the West Coast. You need to know what your cost structures are. So let's say you pick an item, and this is just an example. Let's say you think you can hit an average selling price of $30, and your cost for those items, let's say, is on average $5 a piece. So your gross profit is $25, but that is not all of your expenses, of course. You need to plan on saving or spending probably half of that amount on the various selling fees and expenses, supplies, bubble mailers, boxes, whatever it is you need, and to set aside money to pay taxes, because you're now responsible for paying your quarterly taxes if you're self-employed. So let's say that's $12.50, half of it you want to save for those expenses. Now you got $12.50 in net profit. And remember, this is just an example. Your niche is going to have its own numbers. Your ASP may be $15 or it may be $150, but doing this exercise will help you get to the number that you want to make. So I want to make $50,000 a year, just to pull a number out of the air, and I expect to sell for that average margin of $12.50. I need to sell about 4,000 items a year in order to make that math work. $50,000 divided by $12.50 per piece, net profit. That's not gross sales. People get caught up in average selling price and gross sales. At the end of the day, those numbers are important, but the double bottom line for you and your family is how much money you make net to take out of the business after taxes. So in this example, and again, the numbers will vary depending on your niche, I'm saying at an average net margin of $12.50 per item sold, you're going to need to sell 4,000 items. Now, again, just to counter that, if you're selling an item where your margin is now $50, to hit that $50,000, you only need to sell 1,000 items a year. So the niche that you're in, the products that you sell, the cost of those goods, and the margin that you can make has a huge impact. I chose books and media, which have a lower average selling price, a pretty high gross margin. So my number's pretty high. and it sounds like Brandon, who is a media seller as well, mostly CDs, if I've been following him correctly, he's going to be in a similar situation. He's going to need to sell a high volume of transactions at a low selling price and a lower net margin dollars to hit the kind of income that he's calculated for himself. Again, just remember those numbers will vary. And if you have been selling part-time for some time, you got a pretty good idea what those numbers are. You know how much you're selling things for. Assuming you've been doing good accounting, at least, you know what your average selling price is. You know how much money you're making on each item. You know what you've been able to take out of your business for your own personal, whatever, your vacations or your car payment or whatever. So you got an idea of what those numbers are, and you can begin to extrapolate them into full-time numbers. So the next thing, obviously, is to start to look at a sell-through rate. How many of these things are selling versus how many of them are listed? If you've been selling, again, part-time, you've got a pretty good idea what that number is. Your current listings divided by your number of sales of that type of item gives you a pretty good idea of what your sell-through rate is. As an example, again, let's just say your sell-through rate is 50%, just to keep it easy. To sell 4,000 items annually, you'd probably need to list something close to 8,000 items over the course of the year. Now, remember, that's not, you don't want 8,000 necessarily active listings at any one time. But as you go through the process of a week and a month and a year, you're going to list 8,000 items at a 50% sell-through rate to sell 4,000 items. So your active listings in that kind of scenario might be 1,000 or 2,000, something like that. I saw a seller recently that did a video, and he made the point that he thought having a high listing goal was a bad idea. And again, that's one of those kind of generic pieces of advice that in a vacuum probably seems like a good idea. But here, Brandon and I are two examples of people who are selling at lower average selling prices with lower net profit dollars coming in, where a high number of listings is super important. If you're selling $200 items that you're making $150 on, your math is very different than Brandon and mine. You can sell a lot less stuff at a lot higher dollar amount to make the same kind of money. And that's why a lot of people don't focus on things like books and media, because they are high transaction, low dollar volume type items. I talk about it on this show almost every week. There are dozens of ways to do this successfully. So again, in my case, when I did that calculation, when I first got started, I decided 5,000 listings active was probably about where I needed to be to sell enough things to make kind of what I thought was the bare minimum amount of money. Again, your mileage is going to vary, but that's the calculation. That's the kind of math, the kind of pre-work I would recommend that you do. In my case, I'm still growing my business. I currently have about 10,500 listings. I'm well beyond what I thought was kind of the minimum or even the average expectation of what I would make doing this. Again, I'm not making what I was making as a retail manager for a company like Best Buy, but I'm making a very nice living selling books, and I have control of my time. So again, that for me was vitally important. Again, remember, items listed at an average selling price of $15 are very different than items at $50 or $100. And when you see sellers talking about those gross numbers, talking about their average selling price and talking about their gross sales, those things in a vacuum are not relevant to your specific business and the things that you want to do and the things that you want to achieve. I've talked about it regularly on the show. Comparison is the thief of joy. If you're looking at somebody who has an average selling price of $60, but it doesn't really talk about the stuff they sell, they just say, oh, my ASP is $60. They haven't told you anything. You don't know what they're selling. You don't know what their costs are. You don't know what their shipping expenses are. You don't know enough about their business to really understand if that is a great number or not. So don't get caught up necessarily in what other people are doing. Think about processes like this that I'm laying out for you today about how you can determine how you can get to the number that you actually want to make. And don't worry about what the rest of us are doing. So once you've settled on that number, think about whether or not you can actually source that amount of stuff in your area. If you are in a sparsely populated area and you've picked, for instance, media, you need to evaluate, can I source 8,000 items a year to list? Is there enough electronics in my area, or am I going to have to expand my horizons? Am I going to have to buy pallets? Am I going to have to do something different to be able to make this work? Or do I need to consider adding different niches to my market? Again, I'll use me as an example. I've been pretty lucky. I chose media and I've been able to buy massive quantities. If you've been playing along at home for any length of time, You know, I did a buy of over 8,000 CDs at one point, 15,000 books that I bought over the course of a summer. One of my very early bulk purchases was 600 plus Blu-rays. So I've been fortunate to be able to get the kinds of quantities and at the kinds of costs that I needed to make my math work. Do that same thing for yourself and you'll be golden. Just to give you an example, again, the retail value of my items is closing in on $200,000 listed at any one time. My actual cash tied up in those items is less than $4,000. That's the other thing that you need to consider. Not only can I source that number of items, whatever it is, 500 items, 8,000 items, can I afford that level of inventory? Do I have $4,000 available over the course of a year to invest in inventory? You should, if your business is growing and is prosperous, be able to accumulate enough money to keep growing to get to that number. But that's another consideration when you think about what kind of products you want to sell. Can I afford to invest X amount of cash to get the amount of listings in this category that I need in order for it to be successful? Then you start making other evaluations. Do I want to try to sell things with higher average selling price? Do I want to try to reduce my purchase costs? Do I want to negotiate more at an estate sale or a garage sale? Do I want to try to cut other expenses? There's multiple ways to do reselling, and there's multiple ways in this business, of course, to make money. From there, Brandon asked, how did I get to 10,500 listings? It was work. Reselling is hard work, and I've talked about that on this show as well. I think a lot of times resellers on YouTube in particular tend to undersell how much work is actually involved. As I talked about at the outset, the level of stress of not knowing necessarily whether that purchase of 15,000 books is going to be a good buy or not, and weathering a bad week or a bad month in sales is stressful. And then you add into that the level of just actual physical work, doing the listings, taking the photos, shipping the stuff. This is a real, I say frequently, this job is simple, but it is not easy. It requires a lot of work. And when I got started, as I outlined above, I set my target at 5,000 listings, and I did sometimes 200 listings a week. Again, with these big buys, I had plenty of inventory, so I was able to do that, and I worked out a process where I could quickly and efficiently list that level of items until I got to the number that I wanted to get to. Since then, I've been able to back it down. If you follow me over on Instagram at GalaxyCDsRocks, you'll know that I do on average anywhere from 85 to maybe 125 listings a week now. I'm not trying to grind out 200 listings a week anymore because I got to the number that I had set for myself. I measured the results. The sales were roughly about where I expected them to be. I will caution you, it's not necessarily linear. If you have 100 listings and you're doing X number of sales, you might be inclined to think if I double it to 200, my sales will double. That does not necessarily always work out to be the case, but it should be pretty close. It gives you a fairly good guide. In my case, the numbers worked out, and I was able to kind of back off a little bit from that intensive amount of listings. But yeah, I was listing a couple hundred things a week. I spent a lot of time down here in the Batcave working on this. Develop a routine, a system, a process that works for you that allows you to be quick and efficient in getting your listings done until you get to your target. And again, I will say this, it's very different from a listing and from a sales and a profit standpoint to sell $2,400 items a month than it is to sell $420 items a month. Both of those ways of doing business and reselling can be very, very successful and very, very profitable, but they absolutely require different kinds of work. If you're selling clothing or electronics, you may spend time cleaning, repairing, whatever, those items. Where if you're selling media, you're just grinding away doing listings. There's not really much you can do to fix a CD or a book or whatnot. So those things all factor in to whether or not you can make money and how you go about doing it. So again, just to recap, this was a fairly long. I hope you got something out of this. And if you did, do me a favor if you're watching on YouTube and hit that thumbs up button. But in closing, I would say those are the three important things. Know yourself in terms of your tolerance for risk, your self-discipline, and the skills that you have or you need to develop in order to be successful at this business. Know what your financial needs are. Be sure that you think about things beyond just the salary. Remember things about health insurance that your company pays, 401k and retirement and those sorts of things, all the extra expenses, the difference in potentially tax structures that are going to be involved in the money, and decide where that number is. Maybe you want to make more. Maybe you're a case like me where making more money than I was making previously was not the goal of this. Recapturing my time was, and I was willing to make less money, not a ton less money. I still want to make a good living, and I still want to pay my bills, and I still want to have everything covered and be able to do the things I want to do. But that number for me was no longer necessarily a six-figure income. I was willing to do something different. Again, that goes back to the point that every situation is different, and you need to do that math for yourself. Selling full-time can sound like the ultimate dream. And for some people, it is. I, frankly, have never been happier with my job. And the control I have over my time and the things I do, I absolutely enjoy doing this work. It has been fantastic for me. But I had some advantages. I had some financing available to me if I got in trouble. I brought some skills that I had developed over the years in retail management. I'm self-disciplined enough that even on a nice day when I want to be doing something else, if I've got to get something done, if I've got to ship orders, if I've got to hit my listing target, I will be down here doing that work. Know yourself and know that you have the ability to do that, because if you don't, the dream will quickly become a nightmare because you'll find yourself dreading going down to do listing. Everybody likes to source. Nobody likes to list is kind of the old saying. You've got to be able to do those things if you want to be able to make money. So know what you can and cannot do. Some people need the structure of a traditional job and the consistency of a regular paycheck. And that is absolutely fine. There's absolutely no shame in that. Most of the population of the world would probably fall into that category. And if that's you, going full-time is probably not, despite how it sounds, is probably not the best idea. Continue to do it part-time. Enjoy it. Make your extra money, make your fun money, make your car payment, your vacation. But don't try to make it more than it is if you are not the type of person who does well not knowing what your income is, or does not do well without structure and supervision. You need to really be self-critical before you decide to jump into this. So again, hopefully you got something out of that. If it was useful for you, please do me a favor and hit that thumbs up button. Share this with anybody else that you know that might be considering going full-time in this business. I can tell you, from my personal experience, if you do it right and you do it well, it can be very rewarding, both financially and emotionally. It has been fantastic for me. But again, I would not necessarily recommend it for everyone. Doing it, how you do it, and when you do it is up to you. And hopefully this discussion has given you some idea of some of the things that I did and I would recommend that you do in order to make that decision for yourself. With that out of the way, let's get into some reselling news.
News updates.
So Amazon made an announcement this week, came out on April 2nd. This is on Sourcing Journal. Amazon to delay new controversial selling fees until May. And that should have an asterisk next to it. Amazon is postponing a low inventory level fee it recently introduced to its third-party sellers who use the company's Fulfillment by Amazon FBA service after some predictable seller backlash. We talked about that when this was announced a couple of months ago. The tech giant, however, is not voiding the fee entirely. They stated in a post on Seller Central Forum on Monday that it's still going to charge the FBA low inventory level fees incurred between April 1st and April 30th, but after the end of the month, Amazon says they will credit sellers back for that fee. So they're technically they're waiving the fee, but they're waiving it in a way where they're still going to charge you for it and then give you a credit back for it at the end of the month. The fee will then be reinstated with no credit beginning on May 1st. They said, quote, "We have heard feedback from a number of sellers that they are still uncertain what the exact effect of this fee will be on their business," the Post said. "To help you better see how this affects your business in real time, we will provide a transition period during the month of April." So essentially what they're doing is they're going to charge you the fee so that you can look at your business, kind of like we just talked about, do the math, evaluate the numbers, and see what the impact is on your business. How often and how much are you being charged in this fee, and what can you do to offset it? How do you control your inventory levels in order to not incur this fee? One of the problems, of course, with Amazon FBA at the moment is that they now have a low inventory fee, but they also have increased storage fees if you have what they consider to be too much inventory. So finding that sweet spot is incredibly difficult. And again, many businesses are seasonal. The number of items that you might need in inventory in Q4 is very different from the number of items that you might need in inventory in Q2. And sellers are concerned, of course, that Amazon's algorithm or AI is not necessarily always that great at calculating. This fee was first announced back in December. The fee applies to products with consistently low inventory levels relative to their unit sales, which Amazon refers to as a seller's, quote, historical days of supply. The low inventory level fee applies when Amazon estimates there are less than 28 historical days of supply left for that product. This 28 days of supply is calculated based on long term, which is the last 90 days, and short term, which is the last 30 days historical sales. So that's their effort to kind of balance out the seasonal or monthly variations in sales. They look at and do some kind of math to average out long-term 90-day sales and short-term 30-day sales and come up with a 28-day number. The fee will only be charged if inventory falls below 28 days, historical days of supply, according to both long-term and short-term data. Amazon argues that maintaining sufficient inventory levels allows the company to, quote, effectively distribute products across its fulfillment network, thus improving shipping speeds for customer and ideally driving more sales. Over the past year, the e-commerce giant has continued to shorten its delivery times, increasing the number of items delivered the same day or overnight in the U.S. by more than 65%. So from their standpoint, this type of inventory control has been very, very good for them. Sellers, of course, think it's ridiculous and that the fee is just a cash grab, which they may not be wrong. I don't sell on Amazon, so I can't comment. If you are an Amazon seller, you can let me know in the comments below what you think of this fee. Seller fees, of course, have been a massive revenue generator for Amazon. Third-party sellers accounted for more than 60% of items sold on Amazon during the fourth quarter, which we talked about when we did the Q4 recap. And with the company reeling in a massive $140 billion from seller fees alone in 2023. So huge, huge cash to Amazon from third-party sellers. And to be fair, they continue to squeeze the sellers from both ends with added fees. I've talked to a lot of sellers who have all but abandoned Amazon as their primary platform because the fees are just out of control. And in a case like this, very difficult to actually calculate because they vary from month to month. This was an interesting one. This is over on E-Commerce Bytes. Good news, eBay subsidizes differences in return shipping. eBay, of course, encourages sellers to accept returns, which is obviously always a contentious point. It's one of the things that sellers commented on that they were most fired up about with the changes over at Mercari. Many sellers said they were leaving Mercari strictly because of their change in returns policy, where they were going to basically allow no questions asked returns. So this is always a contentious issue with sellers. During a podcast, employees revealed that eBay subsidized the shipping return label in cases where it costs the buyer more to return the item than it costs the seller to mail it. That's good news for sellers who might worry about being on the hook in the case of customers returning items using bigger boxes and more expensive shipping services. eBay for Business podcast hosts Kayomi Kayoshi and Jim Griff Griffith said eBay charges a seller no more than the amount they paid to ship the item. You can let me know in the comments if you have found that to be true. Now, I have not taken a return in 60-odd days, but the last one I did was a book that I had sent out by media mail, and the return label that eBay generated was priority mail, and I was charged the full amount for that label. It was not subsidized for me. I paid the full pop for getting this thing back, which was about three times what the media mail rate was for this book. Granted, again, that was a couple of months ago. So if this is a fairly recent change at eBay, let me know if you have seen this, if you have gotten something back returned that came to you either in a bigger box or shipped in a different method by priority mail or ground advantage that was more expensive than the way that you sent it out. And if you saw that in your fees, you were only charged back for the original amount of shipping to get the item back to you, if you do returns at all. I've not had a return in quite some time, but that has not been my personal experience. They said they were answering a question from a seller who said they had mailed an item via media mail, just like I said, but the buyer returned the item using the more expensive priority mail. The seller said they were pleasantly surprised that eBay did not charge them the extra cost of shipping. To answer this, they said, and give you some perspective, when the buyer uses a carrier and class of service that is more expensive than the one the seller used to ship the item to the buyer originally, eBay covers that cost difference. The seller is only charged for return postage in the amount of the original shipment. Please let me know in the comments below if you're watching on YouTube if that has been your experience, because it has not been mine. Griffith also addressed the issue, stating, quote, "As you know, you can see this in your transaction report. You'll see that this is the amount you were charged. I think people find it hard to believe that eBay would actually subsidize the difference." Yes, we do. And it doesn't happen as much as you might think. No, it doesn't, because it has not happened to me ever. I'm editorializing a lot on this one because this is just, if they're actually doing it, I'm all for it. It's awesome. But my personal experience, which is not necessarily the experience of everyone, is that this is not the case. They say it's not the seller's fault. It's not the buyer's fault. I mean, it's just whatever happened. They used a different label, so we pay for the extra difference and move on to the next transaction, so you don't have to worry about it. Again, do me a favor. Let me know if you are finding this to be the case, because in my case, that is not happening yet. I'm knock wood, I'm not trying to get a return to see if this actually works or not. My returns percentage is super, super low, and I'd prefer to keep it that way than to see if this credit is actually working correctly. That's all I've got in the reselling news for this week, but now we've got a really big What's Old recap. So I got a couple items here right off the bat. I talk about yearbooks pretty regularly. If I can buy them for $3, $4 a piece or less, I will generally grab them up. I've seen some estate sales where yearbooks are inching up into that $10 price bracket, and that's a little rich for my blood. But at $2, $3, $4, I'm usually a buyer. They can be long tail items. They can take a while to sell, but here we've got one, the 1979 Golden Cords Union College yearbook from Lincoln, Nebraska. This was from 79. And oh, look at this. Here's another one from 1980, the same college. This sold in two different weeks to the same buyer. He has since actually bought another one. I had three of these all from kind of the same time period. It's either 78, 79, and 80, or 79, 80, and 81. They bought all three one at a time over the span of 3 weeks. I own these things for $3 a piece. I sold them on best offers at $20 a pop plus shipping. So yearbooks, again, if you're a bookseller or you're interested in books and you can pick these up, they can be slow sellers. These went fairly quickly. I've had these less than a month, but I've got some that take quite some time to find the right buyer. Interesting old book. I picked up a big lot of these at an estate sale for a couple dollars a piece. Gosh, probably 2 years ago, Multi-Level Hillside and Solar Home Plans. These were published by Garlinghouse Company. They were 70s and 80s era kind of books of generic home plans. I picked up a big lot of these for a couple of bucks a piece. This one was from 1981. I had it listed, I think, for $24.99 and sold it at 15% off at $21.59 plus shipping. over on eBay. Purdue, congratulations to the Boilermakers going to the national finals in men's college basketball. If you're following that, my bracket is totally crushed. but it's been a fun tournament. But the Boilermakers going to the finals, they had just won in the regionals, and I had this old small like drinking glass, vintage Purdue University Boilermakers drinking glass. It was not very big, but it was a fairly hard to find type item. I've had it for quite a while. It was discounted in my current sale. This thing sold for $22.49 plus shipping. I bought it at an estate sale, man, probably 2 years ago for a dollar. A couple of old math textbooks. I was at a sale, six, 7 weeks ago, and there was a table full of these old kind of staple-bound teacher's guides for math books from the 60s and 70s. They were a quarter apiece. I looked some of them up, and they appeared to have some value, so I just grabbed the whole bunch of them, threw them in a box. So I'm into these for 25 cents a piece. From 1973, Boxes, Squares, and Other Things, The Teacher's Guide, and another one, 350 Ideas for Teachers by Abraham Resnick from 1961. These are 30, 40-odd page, staple-bound, 5x7 booklets that I own for a quarter apiece. These sold through eBay's international shipping program. The combined total was $24.98 plus shipping, so 50 cents into $25. That is a pretty nice gross margin. Another book, The 9 Bad Shots of Golf and What to Do About Them by Dante and Deagle from 1961. This is not actually even a first printing of this paperback book, but it is fairly hard to find in its older guise. I picked this up at a estate sale it's probably been 2 weeks ago now, and listed it and sold it almost immediately for $24.99 plus shipping. Religious books I talk about pretty regularly. Here's one, Scenes from the Throne by Richard M. Bradley. This was a paperback book, one of only 600 that were printed back in 2005. This was part of a big lot of books that I own for about 16 cents a piece. This sold for $27.99 plus shipping over on eBay. So you're probably unlikely to find this since there's only 600 of them out there, but it was a fairly nice flip. Really old, interesting book. This was from 1893, published by Thomas Y. Crowell, Evangeline by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. This had, I don't know if this was an original cover or not, but it was like a Bakelite or plastic embossed, raised cover on this book. It was a really, really cool piece. I picked it up at an estate sale for a dollar. It's hard to see, I think, probably on YouTube, but it had a decorative, like, floral arrangement that was physically raised three-dimensional on the book. That had been chipped in some spots from storage, so this wasn't really in pristine condition, but it was interesting enough that I just grabbed it. I didn't even comp it at the sale. I just grabbed it and threw it in my box. Bought it for a dollar. This sold on a 15% off offer for $29.74 plus shipping. Another old book. I don't know why the photo did not show up on here, but La Perla by John Steinbeck. This was a Spanish edition published by Appleton Century Crofts, illustrated back in 1949. Picked this up at an estate sale for $2 and sold for $29.99 plus shipping. Bought a big lot of, actually, this came from, I lease warehouse space. We've talked about I have a space in a warehouse here in town, and there is a former worker in that warehouse who had essentially half of the third floor just full of stuff, and he no longer works for the warehouse, and he had been told he needs to get all his stuff out of there by the end of April. So he's been packing up and moving his stuff out, and he knows I sell books, and he said any books he comes across, he would just put in a box and leave in front of my unit because he didn't want to mess with them. Again, it's one of the reasons I love books, because some people will just literally give them to you. and you can't beat that kind of margin. So this was part of what he had stashed away, and he left in front of my door. The Barbizon Models Handbook. It was an illustrated paperback. Did not have a publication date, but based on the hairstyles on the cover and in the book, I'm guessing it's from the early 80s. Again, this was free to me from the guy in the warehouse. It sold initially, this sold on Etsy. And within 5 minutes of having been sold, the buyer sent me a message saying that they had ordered this by mistake and would I cancel it? I don't know how you feel about that. And again, you can let me know down in the comments what your take is on this. But I'm like, the number of steps that you have to go through to actually purchase and pay for an item, it's hard for me to wrap my head around how you would make a mistake, how you don't realize going through all those steps that this is not the thing that you want. It happens a few times a month, and I just cancel them and move on with life. It is what it is, but it's just an interesting phenomenon because I, speaking for myself, can say I have never, ever bought something, gone through all the steps, put in my credit card and my address and all that stuff, paid for the item, and then been like, oh, nuts, that's not the right thing, and I have to cancel it. I've just never done it. You can let me know in the comments what you think of that, but this sold over on Etsy and was canceled, and then 2 days later, relisted and sold on eBay for $32.99. This was part of the big 15,000 book lot, so I'm into this for, gosh, I don't know, 4 cents and some change. Cyril Falls, War Books, an Annotated Bibliography of Books About the Great War. So this is essentially a book about books about World War I. Really interesting piece, very difficult to find. Again, I'm into it for less than 5 cents. Had it listed for $39.99 or best offer. Received an offer of $33.99 plus shipping and went ahead and sold this thing. Another old book. This is an interesting one. Not exactly a yearbook, but some of these Who's Who books can be pretty interesting. This was Who's Who in American Art from 1959. It was published by the R.R. Boker Company. It was a hardcover that essentially just listed artists from all over America for that year. This was part of another big lot of books that I own for about 16 cents a piece and sold for $34.99 over on eBay. This was an interesting one. So I bought a big box of different flyers and little booklets and whatnot. It was just a random box at an estate sale, kind of like ephemera stuff. It was $5 for the whole box. So I'm into this particular thing for probably less than 5 cents. I'm going through the box and I'm finding interesting items. And this thing comes up. It's actually from the area that I currently live in here in Hamilton, Ohio. Weber's Hardware, a Keen Cutter pocket calendar and address book from 1958 and 59. So this is a pocket sized 3x4 sized little booklet with this hardware store's information and the brand Keen Cutter on the cover. Inside the cover, 1958 calendar, back cover, 1959 cover, and in between, like a little planning calendar, address booklet, place for notes, weights and measures. Really interesting little piece in this box. I couldn't find anything like it, but I saw that Keen Cutter stuff in particular seemed to bring some decent value. So I listed this thing starting at an auction at $19.99, and it received multiple bids, finally selling for $36.99. So none of this had been filled out. It was a little bit worn, but whoever had had it never wrote anything in it, never put any addresses in it. It was absolutely clean in that standpoint. $36.99 out of essentially a nickel. First sale of the week over on Etsy. This is an old manual, the Hall Effect Manual from Beckman Instruments. It was published back in 1964 as a second printing illustrated paperback. The Hall Effect apparently was something that was discovered when applying electricity to thin sheets of metal back, I think, in the early 20th century. And it initially was not deemed to be an important discovery, apparently until the advent of the development of semiconductors, at which point being able to do things with thin pieces of metal by charging them with electricity became important. And this is a very early text on that effect and how you measure it and how you utilize it to do certain things. Really unusual piece. This was part, again, of a big lot that I own for about 50 cents. This thing sold for $39.99 plus shipping over on Etsy. What have I got here? A bunch of, I've talked about like the old science fiction books that I buy. If I can find big lots of paperback books, I'll generally grab them up if I can get them for 50 cents, a dollar, $2. Here is a one sale person bought five of these various vintage 1950s and 1960s and 1940s era Theodore Sturgeon and Murray Leinster science fiction books, five books total that I owned for about $5 total that sold for $40.15 plus shipping. I love these old sci-fi books and digests. They're so fun to go through. And I've, to be fair, I have an entire stack of them next to my reading chair right now that I intend to get to at some point. So I do occasionally steal stuff from my stash to read and then sell later. But I just love working with these old books, even though they're not necessarily high value. Another item over on eBay. This was part of a group of books I bought in an estate sale. I've talked about these kind of over time. I own these for $6 a piece. Very rarely do I try to pay that much money for books, but when I looked at these, they were old enough and unusual enough and looked to have high enough value that it made sense to make that investment. So I bought, I think, six or seven of these books for $6 a piece. This one was A Practical Discourse of God's Sovereignty with Other Material Points Derived. This was from the late 1800s. It had been rebound by whoever owned it previously in a custom leather binding. The binding was actually in really good shape. The book, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see it's got lots of tanning and foxing and staining. All in all, for a book from the late 1800s, it was in pretty good condition. I had it listed for $99.99 or best offer. I randomly got an offer for $70.81 plus shipping from $6. That's a deal I'm going to take every day. I mentioned, I think, a couple of weeks ago that I had picked up a big box of Seventh-day Adventists religious tracts. And for the most part, there were no comps on any of these. Nobody had these listed. I had essentially the only ones that I could see on many of these. And I had an international buyer who bought, I believe it was eight of these total. It's hard to see on YouTube because I tried to get a picture of all of them, and I can only get four of them on the screen even. But these were all written by J.L. Tucker. They were from the Quiet Hour Missionary Booklet series from the mid to late 1970s for the most part. Eight of these religious tracts. I bought this whole box of these things. Again, I paid $10 for this box. I'm into these for roughly 5 cents a piece. So eight of them I was into for 40 whole cents, and this sold for $99.92 plus shipping. I have these listed mostly for $12 to $19.99, depending on what they are and how big they were, and this person bought eight of them, totaling $99.92. So really cool sale. Again, anything unusual, religious, I will definitely look at, and in a case like this where I can get them super cheap, I don't mind spending the time to list $12, $13, $15 items when I'm into them for a nickel. Those kind of profits make sense. These are really, really small, easy to store, easy to ship. It's, again, a high volume of transactions and a low dollar amount, but as I talked about in the when do you know that you can go full-time portion, these things all add up. This is essentially a $100 sale that is, for all intents and purposes, almost $100 in profit. It is a win-win, and I will take these kind of deals all the time. Last thing, this is your flip of the week for this week. This sold also on eBay. I've had this for some time. This was part of a big bulk purchase I did, a couple years ago. I'm into these for about 16 cents a piece. This was a set of 28 volumes, Isaac Asimov's Library of the Universe, 28 volume illustrated hardcover set from 1992. Really neat set. A couple of them had some minor damage on them, but a big, big set that I own for about 16 cents a piece. 28 of them, so you can do the math on what that is, but this set sold for $119.99 plus media mail shipping. So that is a recap of kind of the last couple of weeks of stuff that I've sold here at the Galaxy. Been a couple of good weeks, a couple of not so good weeks, as I talked about in the kind of the intro and the initial thoughts on this episode about when you can go full time or whether you even should go full time. As I say with some regularity, not every day is your best day ever. Not every week will be your best week ever. the ability to continue to work your process, do what you know to be the right thing to do for your business is incredibly important if you want to go full time. Evaluating your niche, knowing what you can make money on and how much money you can make on those things, and then backing yourself into the number of how many things you need to list, to sell, to make the number you want to make is incredibly important. As I always say, be cautious of advice that you see on YouTube or in a podcast, which just gives you a generic number of something. You should have an average selling price of X, or you should have this number of listings, or you should do this or that or the other thing. That, for me, again, this is just me, in my business experience and my management experience, it's more about the process that you put in to get to what your number should be than just a generic blanket statement about you should do X or you should do Y. That number, those ideas don't necessarily apply to your specific situation. And if you don't do the work to determine what that situation actually is, you might find yourself in a bad spot. So that's all I've got for this week, folks. As always, thank you so much for spending a little bit of your time with me. If you are not currently a subscriber to the YouTube channel or a follower of the podcast, please consider doing that. Again, if you got anything out of this rather lengthy episode, please do me a favor and hit that thumbs up button. And until next time, it's time to sell. Thanks, guys.
You have been listening to the Galaxy CDs Rocks and Flips Reseller Talk podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will catch you again next time.